This is the Past Lives podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. To get access to the extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives podcast Patreon campaign. And when you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bowne. There is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. This week I am talking to Dr. Christopher Kerr about his book, Death is But a Dream, Hope and Meaning at a Life's End. Christopher is the Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer of Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo. He has an undergraduate degree in psychology, a doctorate of medicine, and a PhD in neurobiology. Chris's background in research has evolved towards the human experience of illness as witnessed from the bedside, specifically patients' dreams and visions at the end of life. To date, the research team at Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo has published multiple studies on this topic and documented over 1,500 end-of-life events, many of which are videotaped. Hi, Dr. Kerr. It's very kind of you to come onto the podcast. We'll be talking about your book, Death is But a Dream, Hope and Meaning at Life's End. Can you tell us how this book came about?
Well, it really came about largely by accident. I started working at hospice 20 plus years ago and noticed the predominance of these pre-death dreams and visions, this kind of non-physical side of end of life, more the experience of illness. And it was so clinically dismissed or found irrelevant that spurred the research. The research did an interesting thing. We published, I think, up to 8 manuscripts now, and didn't receive great fanfare in the medical world, but seeped out to the lay community and has been covered by every major news organization in the Western Hemisphere and gone around the world. And so it was really that's the response to it, which has been fascinating. There was a hunger for this sort of information, for there to be context for what many people had observed. And that's kind of what spurred it on.
One of your first times that you came and encountered death was when you were young and your father died. And there was a thing in the book where you said, as you reached out to touch your father, a priest came in and pulled you away and said, "Your father is delusional, you should go." And I just wonder how treating loved ones like that, and also the person that's dying, that doesn't seem like a very positive thing and could be damaging.
Yeah, I mean, dying is isolating and lonely and made more so by dismissing the experience of it. And anything that disconnects loved ones from the bedside is an injury. So yeah, it's very, very important that it be handled differently and be more humanized, essentially. These are valid experiences. They're, when in our research, the patients report them as striking in their realism, that they're felt, and that shouldn't be dismissed.
So do medical staff get training in deathbed visions at all, or is it just that thing you've got to learn it on the job?
Yeah, no, there's no training. You know, medicine's naturally and ever more so death denying and death defying. We don't really talk much about death, let alone the experiencing of it. That's less true, by the way, for people who are more proximate to the bedside. So nurses, for example, if I give a lecture on this to nurses, everybody nods their heads and I'm preaching to the choir. So the more distant you are from patient care, direct patient care, the less you seem to be aware of it.
So getting on to these visions and dreams that the patients have, there's a guy in your book, he's Frank, and he was age 95, and he exclaimed, "I'm in 1927, I'm a boy, how did they do that?" And so for him, it was more like some kind of actual existence in that time. It wasn't just a dream.
No, in fact, we have trouble. I have trouble with the nomenclature. Dreams is really our only reference point for it. But when we, it's hard to get it out of my mouth because if we're listening to our patients, what they're saying over and over again is, in fact, no, this isn't a dream, or I rarely dream, or I don't recall my dream. We measured realism on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the more realistic, and the most common number picked was 10. So they feel very virtual. In fact, half the time they say they're occurring when they're awake, but it's not like you walk in and you see somebody seeing something necessarily. I think it really speaks to the fact that in dying, sleep is progressive, architecture is rattled, and they may be lucid dreaming, so it feels virtual or lived.
Because they say that these dreams, you say that they're categorically distinct from normal dreams. They feel more real than real. It was as though it was actually happening, is what they were saying.
Yes, that's over again, that's the most common statement. And so proclamations like that, how do they do that kind of thing is very, most importantly, I think what the patient comes out of these feeling is that these are felt or intuited experiences. They're not viewed distantly, but they're participatory. They're in them. And that's really what matters. And so they don't look at them either as a query, as something to be analyzed objectively. They're left with having done it.
And it seems that the patients, they'll have visions. They'll see somebody in the room, perhaps, that is deceased, but it doesn't freak them out. It's not like they think, "Oh my God, I'm seeing a ghost." They just take it, "Oh yeah, here's such and such."
Yeah, so one of the things we did, which was smart earlier on, we knew we couldn't capture these folks correctly, and people would assume things of them like they were feeble-minded. So we filmed them, and which is now was used in the Netflix series, and now a new documentary that's coming out. And one of the things that always strikes me is you'll hear these folks talking, and they're talking about seeing this dead person and that dead person, just matter of fact, which is just so unusual. Yeah, they're never unsettled by.
And it seems that the dying get more comfort. This is what you say: the dying get more comfort from the visions of the dead visiting them than they do from people who are alive visiting them.
Very much. So one of the things we did was we tracked people daily. By the way, just to set the record straight, we always rule out confusion or delirium. You have to sign consents, etc. There's witnesses. And we follow them daily until death. And what happens is there's a dramatic increase in frequency in these events as people get nearer to death. And particularly I've seen the dead. And what's interesting in that is when we measure comfort to content, so whether travel gave you a good score or seeing a deceased person, overwhelmingly seeing the deceased was associated with the highest degree of comfort. So then if you take it together, there's almost this built-in mechanism that as you get towards death, you're ever more comforted. And predominantly that's having experiences where you're reunited with people who you've loved and you've lost. And the people who are in them are also very interesting. It's like there's this editing process. So the people who withheld love or conditioned love are often withheld, but the people who loved and secured us properly, and oftentimes that's from childhood, they're included. So one parent may be there, but not another.
And also there's the thing you say that the end-of-life experiences, they helped with the dying process, but also you had no idea that they could help with injuries that could be traced back to childhood.
Yeah, very much. So one of the more common themes is that whatever wounds predominate from having lived, and we all have them, seem to be often addressed in some form or fashion. And sometimes these are the most meaningful events at all, of all of them. So it could be, you know, PTSD from a war experience. You know, a woman in the one of the films where she had a child who ended up with a drug addiction and in prison, and her whole value as an identity as a mother was questioned. And in her dreams, her parents return to her and tell her what a good person and a good mother she was. We have somebody in the book, for example, who was, you know, born to a blue collar family, not a lot of means, and he lost his arm at age 8. And the question he wrestled with as he developed was, you know, who am I and how am I going to be independent and function and loved and work and be productive and all those sorts of things. And at his end of life, he dreams of his coworkers and family members walking by him, telling him how good he was, and he was the best at what he did. So validating really what was his core injury and concern, alleviating those issues for him.
You also talk about this idea that a large group of patients said that the dead friends and relatives in their dreams just seemed to be waiting for them. It's like they were just standing there waiting.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. We did a paper where we looked qualitatively at the content and themes. And what's interesting is that when you look at this in literature, in other cultures and countries that have been described, the same theme occurs. So there's not a lot said between the dreamer and the person in the dream, but a great deal is understood. And sometimes it just seems to be this presence where not much is said. But again, the understanding is implicit.
When the people are having these dreams and visions, it always seems to be positive relatives that show up. Is that right? Or do they ever see relatives that were perhaps abusive and they're the last people they want to see?
No, that's actually one of the more interesting takeaways. Is I actually can't think of a case. We certainly see it in delirium, agitated confusion, where the themes are horrific. But in end-of-life experiences, which are so markedly different by every and all measure, these people are cognitively intact, they're not disorganized, they're insightful, etc. We don't see that. It's so people don't seem to relive the more pathologic type of relationship. They focus primarily on the positive elements.
All this is emotionally positive, and I think it's like you said earlier, it's almost a build-up because it gets more frequent the closer they get to death and more like it's preparing them to be comfortable and happy when they actually get to their death.
Yeah, you know, I think it does two things. So it validates the life that was led, but it also, in doing so, seems to lessen the fear of dying because it's rerouting you in the fundamental relationships of your life. And in the film, it's fascinating because, you know, this notion, this Dylan Thomas notion of fighting against the dying of the light, is we're not hearing that. We hear a lot of people are happy to close their eyes because they're reconnecting.
There's a guy you talk about in the book called John, who had nightmares about the fallen American soldiers he couldn't save. And this suggests that, you know, not all deathbed visions are comforting, but was this a release for him?
Yeah, so it's actually an interesting story. So when we did our first studies, we naively put comforting, distressing, or neither to click. And it's much more complicated than that. He's actually one of my favorite patients because I was there and it left a mark on me that, you know, it's just one of those experiences that's very hard to forget. But basically what happened was he was involved in days in Normandy and he was on the ship accompanied USS Texas, and they weren't dropping soldiers off to the beach, but they, but some American troop was cornered or captured with geographically in a space where they're being shot. So he and a few other guys went on a took a boat to shore and picked up as many people as they could. And for 67 years, he had horrible post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, his kids came and were interviewed for the book. He couldn't talk of war. He couldn't go to a parade, the Legion, or anything like that. He was extremely traumatized. When he was nearing death, he had to come into our unit because his sleep was so horrific. It was so vivid. And he would see bodies around, and I'm sure survivor's guilt and who could have he saved and that sort of thing. And then one day we went to see him, and he said he slept great, and he had two dreams. And the one dream was magnificent. He got to relive the best day of his life was when he got his discharge papers. And in the second dream, soldiers come to him on the beach and tell him, you know, thank you, and we're going to come for you. And that gave him some kind of closure that he couldn't have gotten from all his years of therapy or medication or what have you. He needed to be released somehow. That's how it happened.
And eventually, I suppose, the nightmares ceased and things were a lot more positive before his death.
Yeah, they stopped entirely, and he was able to sleep. And that's critical because it is very, very hard to die if you can't sleep peacefully. And we understand this intuitively when it comes to physical pain. So if somebody's in pain, you can't rest. Psychogenic pain is actually worse in many ways. And so the physical aspect of dying is generally very manageable. Uncomplicated and wonderfully natural. And if not, it's medically, it's not overly complex, but psychologically, that's a different story. And so for him to close his eyes, for him to find peace, for him to truly rest, and then be able to let go and sleep, which is what dying typically is, he had to find the sort of closure.
There's somebody you talk about in the book called Patricia, who you say you describe as she worked hard to deny religion and did not believe in life after death, but she had also such a profound sort of outcome from the dreams and visions. But did she just sort of, I don't know, accept them as something her brain was doing and there was nothing spiritual there or religious or anything?
Well, she was the most educated, informally educated person I've ever met in my life. So this is somebody who consumed at a minimum two books a week, could recite Shakespeare, and never made it beyond the eighth grade because her mother died, and she had to help care for her father and siblings. And so she intellectualized everything, and that's kind of the vantage point that was important for her. And she viewed this as with intellectual curiosity, but not as without, and denied any spiritual element. Yet at its root, it was all spiritual for her. So, her one thing she wrestled with, again, going back to this idea of being injured in life, was the last time she saw her mother, she was outside of her room and not allowed in. And she was holding up a paper that she got graded from school, and she had gotten an A, and she wanted her to see it. And this is all on film. And she says, the question I've always lived with is, would my mother approve of who I am and how I've led my life? And what ended up happening was at the end of her life, she saw her mother and she smiled. And according to the other aspects that she needed for closure was reunion with her husband, who she said she adored, says it was the greatest romance ever, was her and her husband. And they had this interesting ritual where she would swim in a pool, local pool every day, come home, he'd have tea ready and the crossword puzzle. And he would read and fill in the squares. And of course, she had all the answers. And the recurring dream that she had towards the end of her life, was seeing her predeceased husband sitting at the chair with the coffee, the tea ready, and the crossword puzzle ready to go. So, you know, she tried to deny or prefer not to look at it through a lens of spirituality, but of course that's all it was.
Hello, listeners, this is Simon. Now, some of you know I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyze what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. There's also two other women, Rosemary and Geraldine, and you say they experienced and interpreted their pre-death dreams and visions in diametrically opposed ways. So what happened there?
Yeah, so Geraldine had just had a very, very difficult life with all sorts of violence. And she was a prison guard and lived hard and really felt the only person who had loved her in her life was her mother. And she kind of denied a lot of it, but in the end, she felt her presence and she'd actually see her arms coming to hug her. And she was just a very cold, hard interpretation. And there was only so much of her life that could be repaired upon revision. Rosemary was interesting in that she had dreams very early, and she had quite a bit of death fear as well, and she loved ladybugs, and they were a symbol of good things to her, but she was fearful of spiders, and so she would see spiders, but then they changed to ladybugs, just a symbol of reassurance for her. And then she saw herself actually in her daughter preparing flowers for her funeral, and that kind of eased her death. So different, but the same. You know, they both found peace.
And do you find that absolutely everybody that you come across will have some kind of dreams and visions, or is it only some people?
Well, in our studies, the number we found was almost 90%. Which is slightly higher than other people have reported more anecdotally. But the thing to keep in mind is the people that we, if you're in our study, particularly in the study that got so much attention, this is patients who are in our inpatient unit. So they would come in weeks before death, and we interviewed them literally every day. So being, to capture that kind of frequency, you have to be there a fair amount, and that's what we were able to do.
I suppose there could be patients that just want to keep it to themselves and wouldn't admit it.
Yes, that's a really interesting, you're spot on. And it's one of those things that if you don't give permission people, if you don't provide a framework or give permission for it or space for it to be acknowledged, sometimes it isn't. Other times people are just outward and say, you're not going to believe what I had happened to me last night. So you see the full spectrum. Generally, the longer you live, the more disclosing you are, because if you've lived long enough and you've seen death in any form, you've often experienced this or heard of it. And that's probably one of the most interesting things. If you look at my TED talk, there's a lot of views, but more interesting is the comments. And there's over 5,000 comments, and the good ones are really just people sharing their observations. And that's really one of our goals of this work, was to put it in a caregiving framework that could be understood, normalized, rather than dismissing it, at least have some reverence for it. It's not new. It's been described since the beginning of times in every culture in the world. But this just put some rigor to understanding in terms of frequency and themes and that sort of thing.
Have you come across ever a time where perhaps you have patients in who are very, very ill and the prognosis is that they will probably die quite soon, but then they revive and they actually start getting better again and you're able to send them home? But while they're in that bad state of getting close to death, they have the deathbed visions? Or is it only when people die?
I've done hundreds of these interviews. You're the only person who's asked that very interesting question. And the answer is yes. And so I'll set this up a little bit. So we have a short-term inpatient unit, but we also have a residence down in the hall. And so it's not uncommon for somebody to look like they're on a dying trajectory. And then, you know, you treat the infection or the nausea, and they perk up a little bit and they stabilize in a relative sense and they go into our residence that's more longer term. And we've had a number of people who have come, look like a very close to death, had dramatic increase in frequency of these events. And actually the gentleman who saw his house, childhood home, he was one of them, then do better and the dreams disappear. And then when they start to die again, they return. And I can't tell you how many times I've had patients who the dreams either disappear because they're getting better or they're just not as present, and how often they're missed. And that comes up again and again on film. But you're absolutely right. That's exactly what happens.
You say in the book that the closer to death people become, the more frequent the dreams and visions come to them. Is this something that the nurses or the medical staff would notice, and so they would use that as a way to gauge how close to death someone is?
Yeah, that's actually in part how this work began. So when I came to this, I was to say the least skeptical and dismissive. And kind of what happened to me personally was that I just saw how obviously therapeutic it was, so it couldn't be ignored. The other thing that happened was the nurses I worked with, who've been caring for dying patients in a hospice for many, many years, they view this as predictive. And there was a case that's actually in the film where I thought the patient had more time. The nurse laughed it off because the patient was seeing his mother, who had died. And so what ended up happening was when we tracked patients over time, temporally to death, we could actually prove that there was this prognostic element to it. The content changed, seeing more of the deceased, and of course the frequency. So, you know, the wise nurse absolutely does have regard for this prognostically. And they're right.
So, wise nurse, you say, do you think that doctors and consultants will kind of push back against it and kind of maybe just say, oh, no, we're not taking any notice of all that nonsense, stick with the science?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things going on, which is that we have a medicalized notion of dying, which is that, you know, it's something to be fought or defeated, and it's based on an organ system approach. And of course, people die in totality, they don't die in part. And it's much more than a medical query, it's a closing of a life. So it's natural that there's a change in perspective and even perception as people get nearer to death. And the truth of the matter is the doctors aren't at the bedside in the same way. They're not as entwined to it. And so I think part of over-medicalization is really sterilizing what is a very human experience. Nurses can't really do that, right? They have to be there. In fact, one of the most frequent refers of patients to our first study was a nurse's aide, because she was there and she was present. So I can tell you, as somebody who trained a lot of my young life in medicine, I had certainly had no awareness of this, in training. We viewed patients as, what were we going to do to them? And we often signed them off our teaching service when there was no more things to do to them.
So it's kind of looking at the patient as, a bag of organs, and not yes. taking any consideration for their thoughts and feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly in the West, it is ever more subspecialized. So it's like going to see a number of spot welders. You see the kidney specialist, the lung specialist, the heart specialist. It's very interesting. There's some data now that the more chefs in the kitchen, the less the person actually knows about their illness, because there's assumption that somebody else is owning that responsibility, and there often isn't. You're as likely to get this kind of care from nurses, volunteers, our spiritual colleagues, social work, but less so, I think, from physicians, at least in the West.
There's a phenomenon called terminal lucidity. Would you count that in with deathbed visions and dreams?
That's a great question. So that, for people who are listening, terminal lucidity is an age-old phenomenon that people have, it's just undeniable, that people very near death become more alert and attuned and can recall better. What's fascinating, dementia, patients who may not have been able to remember their family members' names will often gain improved memory. It's a very brief period, and it's before death, so it's like an awakening, basically. I actually think there is a correlation, because, and bear with me, is that memory is very much influenced by context. So music does that, for example. So it rekindles feelings, emotions, that sort of thing. I think end of life experiences do the same thing. A 95-year-old man may have lost his mother when he's 5, and it's her perfume he smells. So there's an emotional driver to these experiences that I think helps kindle recall. There was a song you listened to when you were a teenager that you haven't heard in 30, 40 years, and that song comes up, and you have a memory of something fun you did, when you heard that song. It's a crude metaphor or analogy, but that's the idea, is that there are prompts to re-experiencing things. And I think end of life is one of those times.
So do you talk to hospital chaplains and priests about these things? And do they have a different viewpoint on them?
No, we wrestled with this a great deal, because we're not the first ones to report the absence of reference to religious icons or symbols of faith. But I think we've got beyond that, because I think that this absolutely speaks to the tenets of faith, being love and forgiveness. So Carrie Egan, who was a Harvard theology student, wrote this beautiful piece that was on CNN, What Patients Talk About When They Die. And she says the same thing. They don't talk about church or what have you, but she says that if God is love, the first and last classroom is really our family, and that's what people tend to talk about. So it's I don't think the two things are necessarily incompatible.
Do you see people reporting religious visions and dreams where they might see religious figures and angels and things like that?
Yeah, we've had, and some of this we have on film. Like, there was a young girl who, interestingly enough, was never baptized or been to church with her family. but she had a baby monitor room. And the day before she became nonverbal and the week she died, her mother hears her. And this was actually on the Netflix docuseries. And she's hears her daughter on the monitor, goes in and says, you know, what do you want? And she goes, nothing. She goes, well, I hear you on the monitor. She goes, well, I'm talking to God. So we certainly have lots of incidents that are kind of isolated, but it's not a common thing.
And do you find that children's deathbed visions are different to adults?
Entirely. And we actually wrote a paper on that. And again, these children are filmed. They go through illness and end of life entirely differently. Children don't live regretfully, for one. And they live much more in the present. So even very sick children will, it matters greatly that they go to school or they complete homework assignments, even though they're maybe, you know, a couple of months from dying. They do this well. It informs them. They may not have reference points for death or know somebody. We have a number of cases where they may not have known somebody who died, but they know animals that had. And they return to them alive and healthy. And two of the children that we report on said almost the identical thing, which was that the meaning was that they were not alone, that they were loved. So the message is the same, one of comfort.
Do you find that the relatives, the people who are, I'm talking about relatives that are alive now, the people that visit the patients, they also get something really positive from being aware that their loved one is having these visions?
Yeah, we've actually conducted over 750 interviews or surveys and published this in two manuscripts. And I'll try to sum it up in the best way I can, which is basically a couple of things. One is what the old adage is true. What's good for the patient is also good for the family. The other is that how we envision death powerfully affects how we grieve. And there's actually instruments to measure grief processing. And people who observe their loved ones having these experiences grieve in a healthier, more positive, in a more positive direction. I think it has the ability to redefine loss. So if you view death as what you see in front of you, physical decline, lessening, suffering, you're left wondering what happens when their eyes are closed. Where are they? Are they okay? And, you know, the best example I can give you is if a husband and wife were married for six decades and they had lost a young child, and the husband's looking at his life partner and she's cooing and holding that child or referring to that child, then it does a number of things. It doesn't show loss. It shows love. It shows connection. It shows meaning. It pulls that family member into this kind of dynamic. And it validates the whole having lived. And it suggests, you know, that the best parts of living truly aren't lost. So it becomes very life affirming in the end. So the very positive effects on the bereavement process itself. And the family members attest to it again and again.
Because there's something in your book. As caretakers of the dying, we know that sometimes the best help we can offer our patients is not to interfere at all, but merely to be present. Because I suppose there are some medical staff that if they see a patient having these kind of visions where they're talking to someone who's not there, they might rush to give them sedatives or something.
Yeah, and the risk there, and that's a very important point, is that, you know, this is beyond kind of modern medicine, and that there are natural kind of inherent processes that are going on which are soothing and meaningful, and interference can mean you're sterilizing somebody from their own dying experience, which is wrong.
I was reading a book the other day, which I think was by somebody called Sir William Barrett, that talks about deathbed visions in the late Victorian era, which is, you know, 130 years ago. And it seems like there's been no progress since then in understanding them. And, you know, over that amount of time, you would have thought maybe the medical profession would pay more attention.
I can't believe you're the only person I've ever talked to who referenced this. And it's incredibly important in the evolution of this whole work. Are you familiar with the backstory of Bartlett?
I'm not sure, actually. What's that one?
Okay. So if you don't mind, I'll tell you. Yeah. He was actually a physicist. And I think he was from London, I believe. And here's what's interesting. It actually wasn't him. It was his wife. And she had delivered, who was a physician. And this whole story marks an important inflection point in this whole field, because prior to that, it kind of been under this notion of phantasms or ghosts and all that sort of thing. So here's what happened. His wife, the doctor, who had delivered a baby, and the mother had complications and significant blood loss or infection. She was on was in a dying phase. I think of several days, if not a week. What happened was, during this week's period, the mother's father died in another town, and the physician and the family wrestled with whether they would tell the woman and that her father had passed, and they decided not to. And then what happened was, the young lady began having dreams of her deceased father. And the doctor went home and told her husband, the physicist, Sir William Bartlett, the story. And he was intrigued, and he began a quest really to document and understand these phenomena. So he's the first one who took a somewhat objective approach to recording, and his work carried on for decades. I think you're right. I think that work has been done, and a lot of it's been done in the UK. I think that there's a couple of issues. Is one, a lot of it has kind of been anecdotal or survey, and oftentimes not of the patient themselves. So talking to nurses and doctors and that sort of thing. A lot of storytelling, which has also been important in a form of research qualitatively. The other thing that unfortunately has happened is people are often looking at the dying process, view it as a keyhole which to view something else, either paranormal, religious, afterlife, etc. So there's less work that just views dying as a process and a mystery unto itself. And I think that's what we've tried to do, is just not editorialize or interpret, but just take the words and experiences of dying patients and try to understand them and share them.
One thing we often hear about is that, this is something you mentioned in the book, is that dying patients will wait for a particular anniversary, birthday, or visitor before dying. And it seems like they have control over the time of their death, but I would thought this was not possible. I mean, if your body is going to give up, you don't really have control of it.
Oh, absolutely. So I would try to give you some analogies. So first of all, it takes an enormous amount of energy and strength to be sick and go on. And as I mentioned before, to die well often means that you have to be comfortable. And one of the best analogies I can think of is if it's a Friday night and you have teenagers who are out and about, you know, you want to go to bed, you can kind of close your eyes, but you can't completely rest until you hear that door shut and they know that they're home and safe. It's somewhat like that, in that your world has to be somewhat in order. If you have worry on your mind or concern, it's harder to let go to sleep well. And again, dying occurs within a deeper sleep where you're allowed to let go. So it's very important. Sometimes if we can't, you know, we're in New York and somebody, a family member's in California, we at least try to put them on the phone. So it's you need to have your nest in order. You need to have connected to everybody. Sometimes you need permission. But either way, you need to be put in a place psychologically, spiritually, where you're okay. And unfinished ends don't help. And that's why it's often hard with young death, with a life where there's still many people dependent. You know, I had this happen recently. I had a grandmother here who was tired, and everyone of her contemporaries were all dead. But her children, one of her children was in prison, and so she was responsible for that child's children, her grandchildren. And, you know, horrible, restless time. I mean, physically, she was at the end of life. Philosophically, she was there and ready, but there was this sense of unfinishedness, of responsibility. It's always to other people, and that interfered with the dying process. So there is something absolutely to being able to let go.
So changing this a little bit, have you ever come across reports where medical staff have also seen these visions or had some kind of experience?
I haven't personally, but of course, you know, if you've ever worked in a hospital, there's always lore, you know, of the nun that lived in the hospital who made an appearance at a baby's death or something. I personally haven't. So that goes more to deathbed phenomena. And there's lots of documentation of that. I personally haven't.
I'm going to ask you a question, which you say in the book stops you every time. So what do you think this all means?
You know, I've been trying to be so disciplined to keep it all separate, and I'm not naturally inclined at all. I don't know why, just it's a personal, for whatever reason, my disposition is that I try to keep it in a realm that I can understand. And I've been very, very, we've been very, very disciplined to keep the issues separate. You know, we wanted to be looked at legitimately. You know, I think I end up much more positive and hopeful and faithful, actually, from having done this for decades. You know, you do get the sense there's a better story, that there, it's not as, it's, there isn't the finality we think. And that I love the idea that what we've loved isn't gone. I'm always so taken aback that elder people with compromised recall will feel in the deepest parts the presence and love of somebody they could have lost in childhood. And so this idea, one thing I've come to respect, and I absolutely believe this, is this idea of time in a relative sense seems to not matter so much. So that you're just struck to look at an old body in the ninth decade recalling, you know, somebody who loved them when they were a child. And it's as real as there wasn't the intervening eight decades. I think it's all very positive. You know, so I end up more hopeful, at least of a continued kind of consciousness, if that makes sense, that the dead are still tangent to us in some way.
So do you ever look into the literature with near-death experiences?
No, not a lot. And I'll tell you why is that a little bit, but I'm not very familiar. And they're qualitatively quite distinct. So, you know, our patients are dying. They're not nearing death or, you know, biologically dead for a minute and come back. You know, from what I understand, there's a number of critical differences. The near-death experiences are often, there's some common features like this pull towards something and then being pulled back, the tunnel, the light. I've never heard any of that in our work, not once. The other thing is, There's an analytic component to near-death experiences, or almost a teaching component. Like they'll come back with a message or an understanding or a position, or, you know, they're fundamentally changed in some way. And we don't see that. The time in our population, the time for therapy is over. They don't come back saying, I've got to share this, you need to understand, or I now have unlocked something. It's not as complex as that. It's more about just these relationships that were pivotal to that person. There isn't a need to prophesize or anything like that, or epiphanies. So in that sense, from what I understand, they're quite different than near-death experiences. Does that make sense?
Yeah. There's all kinds of areas you could go into, couldn't you, with this conversation and what it all means and spirituality and stuff.
Yeah.
That we're almost out of time. The book we've been talking about is Death is But a Dream, Hope and Meaning at Life's End. And that's available on Amazon and everywhere, isn't that?
Mm-hmm. It's published in the UK as well.
And do you have a website?
Yes, it's Dr. Dr. Christopher with a C, Kerr, K-E-R-R, .com.
Great.
I encourage people to look because there's links there to the videos, and the videos are very important.
Yes, I really like the video of your TED Talk.
Oh, thank you.
That's very interesting. Do you plan on doing another one? I suppose when they can do them.
Yeah, I never thought I did that one quite by accident, not knowing what they were. And of course, it ended up changing my life. I'm not sure. I would like to see other people carry this forward. I worry about being overly identified with the message. I'd like to see other people chime in, which would just help validate this.
Well, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast. It's been really great talking to you.
Wonderful talking to you.
And that was an interview with Dr. Christopher Kerr about his book, Death is But a Dream, Hope and Meaning at Life's End. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.